Welcome to this episode of Love Bites, your only podcast for detailed breakdowns of the George Lopez Show, episode by episode. I'm one of your hosts, Kyle Overkill. Very excited today to talk about, we were actually going to get to covering George Lopez, but Tim is either running late, I know sometimes he's held up at work. He does this every time where we actually scheduled time to talk about George Lopez. So we won't be able to talk about the episode where George is warning how boys are all evil and Carmen comes home with a hickey and Angie and George go after the boyfriend. And after accidentally meeting a single mother who believes that Max is her son, Ernie decides to use Max to meet women. We actually have a really good episode, it turns out, now that Tim's not here and we can't talk about George Lopez. I am very excited. We're going to be talking to writer, creator, editor, Marcusan Naso about an amazing new book, By the Horns. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me, Kyle. I really appreciate it.
No problem. And yeah, I was going to suffer through that. Before we were recording, I was talking about how I hated the name of the show, and that's how we started doing that dumb thing. I wanted to instantly ask kind of the basic interview questions, and I'm sure you've been asked this, and I'm always interested what people have to do. Tons of interviews are asked, but I feel like the obvious one is what do you have against unicorns, Marcusan?
You know, I don't really have anything against unicorns. I don't know if I've been asked that, actually. I don't have anything against unicorns, but I just thought, you know, unicorns are these mythical, magical beasts. They're always associated with happiness and rainbows. What happens if they were bad? So I just wanted to make a book about that. Or if they just did something bad. And so that's the premise, really, that started the whole thing for By the Horns.
Well, that's what's so interesting about it is, as you read it, I mean, you do such a good job of kind of building in a backstory cleverly without kind of info dumping stuff, that there was an incident with unicorns, and within this world, everyone seems to be okay with the murder of unicorns, but something's going on. But then obviously, it did come out this week, so I won't kind of spoil the very last page, but you do a really good job of, even just in this first issue, kind of set dressing something's up, and it isn't necessarily what you seem. You do a really good job of kind of early on building that mystery, which I imagine is very difficult to kind of pull off in an issue one, which is always, I imagine, kind of getting people to come back.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, I mean, writing number one issues is always difficult. Because, at least for me, I read a lot of number one issues, just like everybody else. And I'm not always invested in the characters. I'm not always invested in the mystery. And you want to hook people on both those fronts, I think, when you're starting a comic book. So you have the plot. You want to be able to have them really get into that world and then want to come back again. And a lot of that has to do with your lead characters and whether you can identify with them or connect with them on some way. And then my books always seem to have humor in them too, and just a lot of different elements, and balancing that and getting that within 24 pages can be tough, but this one actually went pretty easily for me this time around. So I don't know if it's because this is my second book, or just the idea of the story was something that I had fully formed in my head when I started it. But yeah, right in the issue, I kind of knew exactly how it was going to go beat by beat before I even put pen to paper.
Well, I think with the first page is obviously kind of very striking and does a great job of setting the tone. Was that something early on or instantly kind of around the idea that you had for kind of that open for the issue?
Yeah, I always had that open for the issue where you see this unicorn just bleeding and a person standing over the unicorn with a giant axe, and it looks like something bad's going to happen, and then you just jump back in time. And then I wanted to bookend that by showing the unicorns at the end. So you just don't know what's going to be happening in the future. I want to try to build it up throughout the issues and keep you on the fence. You know, you're just not going to know what's going to happen after that opening scene. And but I thought it was a good way to try to get you into the story, like, oh my God, this is going to be a crazy outcome. This unicorn's in jeopardy. You know, what's actually going to happen? You don't know. So that was something I really wanted to build up. I like to have a mystery in the book, in all of my books. But I should say, By the Horns, it's basically the last unicorn meets Kill Bill. So it's a sci-fi fantasy action series about a hunter named Elodie. She wants to kill all the unicorns on the continent of Solithus for trampling her husband. The problem is that it's impossible to find unicorns. So Elodie just starts murdering anything out there with a horn in frustration. Unfortunately, all that monster hunting affects her standing in the farming village of Wayfair where she lives. So the elders exile her for neglecting to help the community. And then she sets out with her telepathic half-wolf, half-deer friend Sajin to try to make one last go at tracking down unicorns and getting revenge. So that's how the book opens. But it takes a turn, you know, as they traverse the continent.
What I think, I mean, like you saying all that, like it is, like, it sounds like almost like kind of a first arc, but you do an amazing job kind of setting that in this first issue. Like, there's a lot of ground to cover, and at no point does it feel like either weighty or overblown. Like, you and Jason actually have two or three pages of no dialogue, but you're still kind of able to set her up as a character. I think that first page does an amazing job of it, but then also kind of the way she interacts and is pushed out, but you feel like, you know, you kind of feel the loss and the grief that pushes her to hunt unicorns and monsters, and like you do all that like within this issue, and it's pretty amazing kind of the ground you cover in it. Is that something from working on Verocious to this that you've, I know you were an editor as well. Is that something you've been able to kind of move forward in kind of like succinct storytelling, which again, like talking first issues is really difficult to kind of do the ground you covered in this issue, I think, pacing wise.
Yeah, I think pacing is the most important part of comic books, to be honest with you. I read a lot of comics and I feel like they're just not paced fast enough. I think there's ways to do it where you get everything in there, but it still moves a little bit faster and you get to the point of what you're trying to accomplish in the book. So, you know, with this one, you know, it's just a matter of writing out character beats. That's how I really start. I come up with the idea for the comic book and then I have to come up with the characters, because to me, the characters are what really drive the story. So I write out character sheets for all of my cast, you know, who they are, what they want out of life, where they're going, how they're going to get there, who are they going to affect along the way, and when. And so that really helps me to determine what I need to get in each issue. You know, the series is about stabbing horned monsters, but it's also about a woman who feels like all she has left in life is revenge. Right. And we've seen a lot of revenge comics over the year. Probably not a comic about a woman who wants to get revenge on unicorns, right. but still. So you have to, if you're going to have a revenge book, you have to have a motivation for the character or a feeling from that character that really sells the revenge, that really makes it feel important to the character and then to the reader as well. So in our book, I also like to do a little bit of mystery too. You know what happened, but you don't know exactly what happened. And so that's something that will unfold as the series goes on.
Right. I think if you kind of laid it out that it was like, I feel like, and obviously I don't want to spoil it, it's like if it was like a straight just trampling, or is there something more to his death or less to his death, like I feel like you would instantly kind of be de-invested in her story. But I think kind of the way you establish it, and obviously with the end, like putting that mystery in, like automatically grabs you to kind of her journey and where that is going to take her. And then obviously looking forward to the conflict with the unicorns, it adds another layer where like you're just not kind of possibly rooting for her just to like kill mm-hmm. these things and be done with it. Something you touched on and again kind of was a driving force in Roche's was that was kind of rolled up in kind of grief and loss and that exploration, and this similarly but kind of filtered through a different way with like this revenge tale with this fantasy sci-fi world. Is that something for you, having those two stories kind of things exploring, that are those topics you like to explore or work kind of well mm-hmm. in comic books to kind of, we talk a lot about like horror and comedy are good filters for kind of any story you want to tackle. Obviously something with like grief and loss, same, you can kind of do that within any genre, but also it's a good way to like drive empathy for characters that you may not necessarily identify with, like Nate was you know, a person of color, this a woman driven story, like it allows readers to empathize when they might, as like a straight white male, like that allows me to identify with them. Is it like grief and loss something you like to explore in your writing?
You know, that's very perceptive, because it's something that I actually thought of afterwards. When I started writing this book, I didn't realize that it was going to be the other side of the coin to Voracious. So By the Horns is built around the way Elodie reacts to the loss of her husband, and loss is definitely the driving force of Voracious. But By the Horns deals with that similar theme from a different, more reactionary perspective. So in Voracious, Nate wanted to do everything he could not to deal with the loss of his sister. He just wanted to try to get away from it. Elodie and By the Horns, she really, really wants to do something about what happened to her spouse. She feels like she has to do it. And that's another reason why I didn't want to reveal everything that happened that caused her to get to that point. Because I want the reader to feel the rawness of her character. You know, it's not about what happened to her husband right now for her. It's all about revenge. It's all about trying to not feel the pain. And so if you were going to explain everything that happened in the past, I think it kind of takes away from that rawness of the character. Whereas in Voracious, you find out right away. It's like in the very beginning, you know what happened to his sister and how it's affected him. In that book, you know, you see that, and then it jumps forward in time. This one, you see the future, and then it jumps back. So I didn't realize that I was kind of doing that, a neat little parallel between the two comics. Now, is loss something I feel like I need to explore all the time in comics? I don't think so. I think that when I came up with a premise for By the Horns, Elodie just needed a reason to want to go after unicorns for, you know, what they did. And so I had to build this story, and that just happened from it. You know, and loss is something that everybody experiences. I just experienced like a really painful loss. My aunt died from COVID-19, you know, earlier this week, after a long battle in the hospital. Thank you. So, you know, I've been with an uncle when he passed away in the hospital holding his hand. So I don't know. Obviously, that affects me, just like it affects a lot of people. And maybe it affects my writing on some kind of a subconscious level, too.
Well, I think it's so interesting you bring up, like, reading the two, like, I think you said I picked up on the, obviously, the dual narratives of loss, but I don't think I thought of kind of what you pointed out, the, we're meeting her, you know, short time after this has happened, and then kind of later there's another little time jump. But, like, so at that, as a reader, we're, like, kind of sitting with her in a different, like, stage of grief and kind of, like you said, kind of mm-hmm. wanting to do anything but that. And so it's really interesting, kind of, like you said, not seeing, like, you don't start off the issue with, like, seeing him trampled. Because, like, this story is, like you said, very much focused on revenge and kind of doing anything like that. So it allows you as a, I think, a reader to kind of sit with that more than if you were to see that happen, because that would be telling like a different tale, like you said with Roche's, mm-hmm. where that was kind of approaching it from a different narrative. So like, it, obviously very clever. I didn't even think of that, but I think that's why it hits harder.
Well, thank you. It's about how the character's transformed. You're meeting her where she is after she suffered something so terrible. So even that first page, it's like, look what she's doing. You know, look what she's become because of something that's happened. And then it's about, well, we'll unwrap the loss and why that's been so powerful in her life. But she's also kind of in a weird middle stage too, because the people in the village feel like, oh, she should have moved on. You know, it's not quite a year. Yeah, it's like a year. You know, she still feels the pain from it. And the villagers are like, all right, well, we kind of gave you time to grieve, but you've got to move on from it. And she's just not ready to do that. You know, she hasn't been able to flip that switch. So when we do reveal what actually happened, you know, that's going to come at a different time when maybe she's going to be able to reflect on it a little bit and see how the way that she's reacted to the loss of her husband has just impacted her and all the people and characters. Well, anthropomorphic characters are mostly in the book, and just the world in general around her. So
that red panda's so cute, man.
Gary Panda.
One carryover from Roche's would be like an injustice not to mention is obviously Jason continuing kind of the amazing art. And kind of to build on that, I think, like you said, kind of the town and their interaction and dealing with her. I mentioned that kind of silent sequence in like the first photo book is amazing. Like kind of what you're able to get across with, again, like you could easily have them arguing. You could say, you know, time's out. Like, but allowing that to see it and then that be relayed to her by what would essentially be her father-in-law in that instance. Like, it helps relate the reader to her and that character, and like it doesn't feel like such a like a hard hit, more like, again, kind of like, you know, take your time and do this. But working with Jason, is that something, working with him again and like kind of the comfortability of you two, and like how has that relationship grown to kind of be able to craft like a really great kind of no dialogue scene like that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, Jason and I co-created Voracious, and we also co-created this book together. So we work really closely on our projects, which I don't think is typical in the industry. Having Jason as an equal partner in all aspects of this book was just something that I had to have. I needed it to create the book, because I want both of us to be really invested in the characters. I want us both to feel like we can, you know, say anything about what's going on in the story. We can give ideas and we can check our egos at the door and just talk to each other about what we're doing, whether it's in the script or the art. So yeah, the silent part, I just really trust Jason, his facial expressions, the way that he does paneling, the way he does storytelling. I do write full script, but I mean, he always surprises me with how he lays it out. And it's just super clear. And that scene was also, to me, I also wanted to capture the fact that here's these villagers. Elodie's been killing horned monsters and just neglecting her duties for all this time. There's not much else to say, you know? I wanted to convey the feeling of, the villagers have had a problem with her, you know, they've given her time to mourn, but now it's time to move on, and they don't have anything left to say except, you know, you have to leave. We can't deal with this anymore. And I felt like that worked better silently. From that panel where you see the elders making the decision, which is pretty clear with all the heads on the table, and then Haru climbing up to the roof where Elodie is before they start talking. I just thought that moment kind of crystallized how the village was feeling at that moment.
And in that scene and several other scenes, especially kind of the fight sequence later, not only just didn't settle on, like, you know, three monsters for her to kill. Like, she kills a shitload of really distinct, unique monsters. Is that something, again, you guys are building out kind of the lore of the world together and kind of, like, the look and feel? I mean, even, like, the birds are fairly distinct and unique. Like, there's very little kind of real world. I mean, like, there's, like, kind of analogs, but there's not, like, distinct, like, you know, you guys are just pulling for it. You guys are kind of, like, changing everything to an extent in this world. Is that something you guys are really pulling from a lot of different things for and working together?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, the monster thing, I mean, so we have a travel page, which I love doing in the book. Where, so we did a whole map of the continent of Solithus, and all the places on it are named after metal bands because I'm a big metalhead. So, which reminds me, I have to finish the playlist for By the Horns. So it was Jason's idea to do that map and have all these different creatures on it, because he likes the idea of just populating a world with all these different creatures and monsters and stuff. That, even though you don't even see her fight all of the monsters in it, you see him on the travel map and you know she's moved from place to place, and so you assumed it, but you don't actually see her fight all of the monsters on the travel map page. But I've gotten really into it. So Jason's like, yeah, can you just do like a couple monsters, maybe like write something about it? I'm like, oh, that'd be cool. I'll write almost a journal entry on how to kill them, because it's very much like Magic the Gathering or like an RPG, you know, where they have all these different creatures that you find in the book, and they all have weaknesses and they all have like hit points or whatever. And so it's funny. When you do the travel page, I would say it's like every other issue. And that first one, I wrote the descriptions, but then you'll see in the next one, which comes out in issue 3, the descriptions just keep getting longer because I'm having a lot of fun like creating the monsters, because I'll sit there and think, all right, this is the area that they're going to be in. Jason loves to draw landscapes and all that, so he wanted to put a lot of that into the book. So the book is heavily influenced by that part of it, because he just wanted to draw different landscapes. But I had to think of, you know, what kind of monsters would be there. And so then I would come up with them. And a lot of them are almost amalgams of creatures that live in those areas. And even the names, you know, I take them from cool things that I like in pop culture. So you'll see in the very first issue, she fights these kind of snake creatures with hands. And they're called Snapentors. And those are named after Snape from Harry Potter and Serpentor from G.I. Joe. So yeah, it's just really, it's really fun. So there's a lot of Easter eggs like that in there, just even in the names. I mean, we've created so many different ones, even ones that don't even make it to the book, that we could almost do an encyclopedia of monsters or in our own RPG at some point, you know? So yeah, the world building is super fun. I like how we do it in a fast way with the map. And you get to see more of it. You kind of get to understand what the world is like, even though they don't stop in every single place. So yeah, that's just me and Jason brainstorming it and coming up with it and just trying to figure out world or ways to make the world seem real and interesting and perilous.
Yeah, and I like, because up until, I think she gets to, and I've been avoiding saying it because I'm terrible at name. Is like the trading port,
Lycus.
Yeah. Like her village is fairly, like, you get the fantasy vibe of it, and a little bit of the sci-fi, and then there's that kind of great action sequence, and then once she gets there, it's almost like the Mos Eisley moment where there's like the lore of this world is like just kind of dropped upon you, but the amazing thing is, and I love, and that's something like me and Tim are big fans of, is like it just exists, and like you're kind of dropped into it, and like everyone else, because this is like their world, like they're not, you know, she's not taken out of it, so like it's just something that exists. So like it's just this, like, as you're reading it, like you as a reader can kind of like imagine what these things are, and bigger stories in it. But it's so like kind of nice just to see that versus like, you know, either the over explanation or kind of drawing upon what that is versus just like feeling very real, like you were talking about, kind of just these like lived in worlds and the readers who kind of you have lived in it, so like it feels that way when you're reading it versus like over explaining or just like, it feels different.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a big fan of over explaining all the worlds and why they are the way they are. I mean, it exists. Of course, there's a backstory that I've created for the world, but it's not important to this story at the moment. You know, I want you to be focused on the journey for Elodie and just feel like, hey, you're dropped into this world. Look at how she's navigating it. You know, that would be cool to see a dragon whale or something like that, but you don't really need to know where they came from. It's the same thing with Sajin, who's a telepathic half deer, half wolf character. You know, you don't know where that character came from. He's just the lead character. There's a tendency, I think, in fantasy wanting to explain everything because the world's so different. But in other genres, you don't get that. You know, if it's just like, I don't know, like a crime noir book, they're not going to explain, you know, how did the city get this way, you know? So I like that. I want you to just follow the character and just marvel at the world that she's in. And as the book goes along, you know, we might sprinkle some things in there about it to try to give you a bigger picture of what the world is like and the people and the creatures that live in it.
It's such an interesting idea because I think you see it a lot in comics. And I mean, obviously the big offender or people could see as an offender is like, you know, Star Wars and kind of going back and explaining the history of everything and kind of like comic fans, I think a lot of times are like, want that for whatever reason. And I imagine like it's a lot of, you know, you want to keep living in this world and you want more of it. But like you said, you look at other mediums and that's not necessarily something that is done. And I don't know why we kind of expect it from sci-fi and fantasy. And, you know, the people who like, you know, I'm a huge, you know, Dark Souls fan. And a part of that is because like it's so broad and like you are figuring out little kernels and like this world and this like odd place just kind of exists and like you can take from it what you want but you don't have to. And like you said, there's like, you know, soap operas are essentially comics and like they don't go into like the backstory of the bar owner, but like you know Star Wars will have, you know, a million Wikipedia pages on it. So it's so interesting kind of where that comes into with kind of the fans of comics and wanting more of that for whatever reason.
Yeah. No, I mean, I understand it, you know, because it's a new world. You're like, wow, this is really cool. I wonder what the backstory is. And I want you to be able to wonder about it too. But I want you to also have a sense of wonder when it comes to just diving into that world. And that's part of the unknown, you know. And in the book too, it's unknown for Elodie because there's a part where she's talking to Haru and he says, you know, you're going to be able to see more of Solithus beyond the valley. You know, she hasn't really ventured that far from it before. So a lot of that stuff is new to her as well. And that was an important part of the experience for me. The other part of it too is, and it's more of a, I guess, technical aspect of it, but, you know, we're indie creators. You don't know how many issues you're going to get to do a comic book, you know. Some of these bigger creators, they can just do an ongoing series or whatever, but we have to do things a little bit faster, you know, try to do a mini series and hope that, you know, we get the audience and we can continue it and do more. That's part of it as well. You know, I like to write the way I write, but I also have to think about, okay, I've got 7 issues. The book's going to be 7. It's been solicited as 6, but it'll be 7 issues. I have to think about, you know, what are the most important aspects in this story? You know, do I want to spend time on, you know, how this village came to be? Or do I want to spend time on the character and the travel and the fighting and the cool creatures that are in it, you know. So it's sometimes it's a juggling act to get the best out of it, but I like that too, because I feel like you might, when you consider those options, you end up getting the best that you have.
Yeah, and I think kind of, especially this year, with the way comics has dealt with everything, and even before kind of the big push, I think, for a lot of the indie publishers, I think you've seen like the rise of Vault and TKO and obviously Scouts. Almost all of those series are specifically kind of dealt with in miniseries or arcs that might go into a second volume, and even anthologies has always been a big part of comics, but even now that's kind of on a rise with Kickstarters and everything like that. And like, it really gets down to the economy of storytelling, and you've just seen like amazing books because of that, I think, because, you know, writers are writing 6 to 7 issues and like really just telling these really great succinct stories, and that versus, again, like a lot of times with the big two, when you have, I imagine it's difficult as a writer to tell an 80 issue Batman story, because like, what are you going to do in 80 issues? Or at the same time, like, you have kind of the creators, they'll give at Marvel like the more unique individual titles, those will be solicited as 10, and then after 5 issues they'll like, okay, never mind, cancel it, like wrap it up in 5, and be like, well, what the fuck, I'm like, you know, I've so like, I think that's where like indie comics has completely destroyed it with, is just like this very smart, obviously kind of marketing campaign, but also like just focusing on the stories and characters and really like these tight things that are just,
yeah, I don't know, I mean, just, I
more
agree,
refined it's... at that point. And like, it makes better writers.
I mean, I love long series too. There's a lot of great long series, but there are a lot of series that I think are just bloated with stuff in it, you know. And I guess it just depends. I mean, it's subjective, you know. What do you like in it? Do you want all the different details in a story? You know, you want it to unfold really slowly, or do you want something that moves a little faster? That kind of trims some of that fat off of it, you know. And then there's always the considerations, again, because if you're an indie creator versus somebody who's really established, and you mentioned like an 80 issue Batman series, you know, working for the big two, I imagine that's got to be tough, because sometimes you've got to do 2 issues in a month. Sometimes you have events, you know, you've got a lot of masters who are coming in to kind of tell you what you can and can't do when you have big ideas for that kind of a title. So that, I think that gets hard, especially if you want to do something that long. But with indies, you know, I like doing a shorter series, although Voracious was longer. I always knew that was going to be longer, and we had no idea that we were going to be able to complete it, actually. So originally it was supposed to be even longer than it was. And then I cut it down to 15 issues, and I was like, actually, I think this works better in 15 issues. So it was like kind of a blessing there. But still, we put out the first mini series, and you don't know if you're going to get greenlit for the second part of it. Unfortunately, you know, we had a lot of loyal readers who just kept getting the book and spreading word of mouth, and we were able to do 3. But, you know, this By the Horns is a little different. I feel like, if when we ended in 7, it could be it, but we're gonna do more. I hear our sales are pretty good and are really good, and Jason just wants to draw more of the world, so he's been sending me ideas like nonstop for what we would do in the second one. And I already plotted out three or four arcs of what we could do with the book. I don't want to spoil anything, but yeah, it's really fun. I have a really, really good ideas for the next series as well, but hopefully people will dig this first series. It seems like people are, and then we'll be able to get to do those other stories too, because we love these characters, we love the world, and we would like to be able to stay in it. And the longer we stay in it, you know, the more you get to see all those little details about how the world was crafted, or, you know, how it came to be, or the different races and people and situations that that happen in Saw Office.
Yes, Panda miniseries.
That's, Jason loves a lot that. Of times, he loves Gary Panda too. He actually did a cover for Gary Panda.
Oh, really?
That's like his incantation shop, and I don't even know if we're going to be able to use it. Maybe it'll go be a variant for one of the issues, but he drew a bunch of covers just because he likes the character so much. It's a really cool cover.
And I'm always interested. So a lot of times when we do these episodes, especially for number ones, sometimes we'll do them ahead of time, and I'll drop them, you know, the week the issue comes out. And I like doing that, but obviously I kind of like recording like around the week they come out or like a little after, because then I think as a creator, like at that point, you know, like you said, people are picking it up and kind of had those reactions, especially given this year, and kind of a lot of times with comics you're creating something, sitting on it for a while, and then getting it out there. What is, you know, this year been kind of like for you doing that, but then also now, like, within this week, kind of getting people's reactions? We were talking before we started recording about like how fast the like horns sold out. Like, there's been like a great response to, like, how is that as a creator? Kind of, I imagine it feels good, but like kind of affirmation and moving forward with the series.
Yeah, I mean, no, it's fantastic. It's really cool. You know, it's what you hope for. You know, we did Voracious and we got some good reaction, but you know, it was smaller. It was a little bit smaller. You know, I don't think the promotion was as good for it. And Scout, like you've mentioned, they've just grown tremendously. You know, I love what Scout is doing here with the new imprints and initiatives, and just damn good series coming out from them. And I just love all the people that work there too, and working with them. And so, yeah, this rollout and the way people are reacting, it just seemed to really, really love the first issue and the characters, and are excited to see what happens in the world. Yeah, I mean, it really wasn't, you were talking about the rollout of it, like the pandemic and all that. I mean, it actually happened pretty fast for us. I came up with the idea when we were doing the final volume of Voracious, and we talked about it a little bit, and then we finished Voracious, and then I kind of changed the idea a little bit, because I wanted to add technology to it and make it more of a sci-fi fantasy. And then we just started working on it, and the pitch documents. I work on the whole issue, because whenever I start a comic book, I want to finish it. I'm not kind of throw something against the wall kind of guy and see what sticks. To me, if I have an idea and I think it's really good, then I'm going to do it no matter what. So even if it doesn't get picked up, I would just self-publish it. So, you know, we pitched the book to a couple places, and it was right around the time the pandemic was starting. And I was a little bit nervous about that. But Scout was my first choice at the time, just because I felt like they had a lot of potential. And now I feel like I had some kind of ESP or something like that, because they've just grown. They've just exploded all over the place with their books and just their awesome, like, out of the box thinking, their distribution, their marketing, their promotion. I just feel like they've taken a huge step forward since the time we signed with them. And so, yeah, we signed, and we've just been working on the book, and it was just a matter of when Scout wanted to come out. And then they scheduled it for February. And so we've just been working on it. I mean, Jason's almost done with issue 6 now. And so, you know, we are pretty disciplined. I create schedules, and, you know, we want to make sure we get everything out on time and have it be the best we can make it. And so, yeah, I mean, it didn't really affect me that much. Because I like to work on one or two books. I'm actually working on another book as well. But I don't really like to work on multiple things. So, yeah, I put a lot of energy into it. And, you know, we just rolled right into 2021.
Yes, Scout seems to be... And, like, I mean, even referencing the horns, like, they're up for... for kind of anything with publishing and promoting stuff, and like that's been so, like been so much fun, obviously with them. And I think one of the new like Bad Idea. Like they're just like insane, like marketing. Like one of the like biggest things that I enjoy about comics and wish there was more of was just like, you know, the fun and like joy you can have with like their comic books. Like even like, you know, depressing Alan Moore comic books are still like fun. Like it's just fun to sit and read and look at. Like, and there's like so much of that doesn't, I think, exist as much. So like, you know, publishers like Scout and TKO and all those that are really just kind of embracing the joy of the medium has been great.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, there's so many great books, and I love all those publishers that you mentioned. I just think they're doing some unique, extraordinary work these days, and I think it's a great time to be a comic book fan. You have a lot of choices and just a lot of incredible creators putting out material.
One thing you mentioned, kind of going back and working in the sci-fi elements, that was something that obviously I found interesting in it, but also, is that easy to kind of balance for you, kind of what fantasy, what sci-fi elements work best in the book, and where though, like, because I feel like a sci-fi could easily, it would be so easy to like have it like I'm blanking on the word, but like it'd be an easy out for her or a situation, but like, so kind of navigating where that would work. I specifically like, I like the fight scene where she pulls out the guns, and again, it's not really like something she relies on, but it's utilized. So like, is it kind of an easy thing to balance for you, like what works when, and like how much sci-fi is present in the world and where it could actually be an out and not?
Yeah, I think it's been pretty easy to put it in there, because to me, the book is fantasy forward, you know, fantasy first. And the sci-fi for me is like extra elements that they use to help them get along, but they're almost kind of matter of fact, you know. Some of them are kind of antiquated, you know, they don't look like super shiny, you know, sci-fi gadgets or whatever. But they have them, you know, almost like in limited quantities, you know. I think you kind of get that when you're reading the issue. You know, there's just like sprinkles of things, like the town has some robots that help them to do farming. Elodie has that hover cart, you know, but you don't see a lot of vehicles and all that in the world. So and I get it, too. But we were talking about before where people might want to know, you know, how did this come to be? And sure, there's like a backstory with that. But to me, I kind of think, you know, if they have this limited technology and they could get to it, you know, would they use it and where would they use it? And there's also magic in the world, too. So, like, where does that come in? How does that come into play as well? I've written extensive notes on all of this stuff, and then I just kind of sprinkle it in and try to mix it in. But I don't want it to ever beat you over the head with technology or the fantasy kind of magic side of it. I want it to feel like it's all kind of blended together. So hopefully we succeeded in that, and then in the first issue and the subsequent issues.
Yeah, I definitely like, I think it's the way you guys utilize it is kind of like you said, kind of complementary. Again, referencing kind of the incantation shop where, like, you know, he has kind of the like holographic LCD screens. I like that the lights are like all these like kind of floating globes. But at the same time, he has like a treasure chest on the table and like these like old like beat up shelves. Like it's usually complimented, but it doesn't feel like, again, like it's littered with the world. Like you said, almost like it's there to add character and, you know, be present when necessary, but like it's not something they're inherently relying on.
Right, and I like that idea of it, because I feel like we are very reliant on technology. I like that this is a little bit different world where it's like, hey, we have this stuff, but we actually like doing it old school. You know, I like that idea of Yeah, you know, if we have a few of these items, we'll use them to make life easier. But, you know, it's actually more enjoyable if we just pull out a sword and chop off some heads rather than use a gun or bazooka or something like that.
It's more personal, more metal.
Right.
One thing as a writer, you mentioned this kind of being like your second main book, and something we talked a little before we got on, but wanted to ask you about, because I'm a huge fan of kind of the C-Court stuff. You did editing on that, and you mentioned you did the podcast. Coming from an editing, I don't say background, but like world as well, like how does that... Having that editing eye, I'm always interested. There's a lot of people that kind of do both, I think. And we see, and again, I think those are people who are very distinct and succinct storytelling abilities. Is that something editing has helped you in your actual writing style, or, you know, even mm-hmm. like I said, really important with the pacing of books?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question, actually. I think so. I think it definitely has helped, you know, because as an editor, you know, you have a critical eye. You put that hat on, you look at something and how it's going to roll out. And, it, you know, is the story going to line up later on? Is the story paced well? You know, is the dialogue written well? Is the punctuation proper? So, yeah, I think it definitely helps, especially when you're structuring stories. You know, I like to structure the story from the beginning to the end. But then when I'm writing, the middle can sometimes change. Almost always changes, actually. But I like to have a basic structure in place. That's how I've always been. I think it's because I've been an editor for so long. I like to have a plan for everything. So mm-hmm. I create the plan. And then once I have that, then I can be free and loose and spontaneous because I always have the structure to fall back on. So I don't know if it's like that for other editors out there, but that's how it is for me. I don't like to charge into things blind, which you know, a lot of creators do that and they do it really successfully. But I like to have a framework. Then I always feel good. I always feel like I'm never going to be out of place. Things are never going to be out of place. I can always go back to that, and I have it as almost like a map. It's my travel map for the comics, just with less monsters.
Oh no, I feel the same. Like even I mean, you were talking, you doing interviews. I think early on, like, you know, years and years ago when I started doing them for sites and stuff, and even kind of like the first, I've talked about it before on the show, when I started doing interviews, a few interviews in, Paul Scheer at the time had been putting out a book, and I was like, oh, like I can ask, he's not going to say yes. And then he said yes, and I was like, I'm way out of my depth interviewing Paul Scheer, and I wrote all these questions, and then like I got so distracted by writing the question, like having these very specific questions and I need to hit them, that when he answered like two questions in one answer, I'm like trying to delete like them out of the doc. And I was mm-hmm. like, you know, it was a lot of dead time. And like going to what just works and comfortable is like, you know, I sit like even, you know, prepping for this one, I read it. I sit kind of with questions in my head. I'll read it again. I'll just type out general ideas, but they won't be questions. I'll just be like, you know, I want to ask about Jason. I want to ask about this. Mm-hmm. And like, so as the conversation happens, you can kind of go into it and like, you have those things to fall back on, but like, you know, writing yourself into a corner is difficult. And when you were talking about like, you know, having a schedule for you guys on it, I was like, that is, you know, that is like the editor shining through. In a way, again, it kind of helps to kind of, it almost mm-hmm. helps more to be able to freestyle when you have that like solid structure and base versus just freestyling the whole thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're doing a great job, Kyle, but you know, that's how it should be for interviews. You know, you're gonna have those questions, you want to come up with some good questions. But you never know where the interview is going to go. So you have to be able to freestyle and be able to ask questions on the fly based on the answers. So I always, when the metalheads, when we interview bands, every episode. So I always come up with lots of questions, and I used to do even more, but I am pretty good at asking on the fly. And we also have six guys on the show who are asking questions. So I've actually started writing less questions. There's like, you know, maybe three or four that I really want to ask, because I think that they're just different questions. But during the interview, I always come up with more questions as it goes, you know, and it's like that with writing too, you know, not questions about the actual script, but when you're writing and you have the basic outline for it, and then, you know, you're thinking about, oh, what's this character going to do next? What's this character going to say? It might change, or you might move it around in that script, or you're like, you know what? I think this will be better in a later issue. So I'm going to take that out and I'm going to work on something else in the script that is important to furthering the story and the characters. So yeah, man, that working on that stuff from editing to interviewing, I think all of that stuff helps, you know, and the more you do it, the better you get at it. You know, that's why I'm glad that I started writing comics later. I think I could have done good comics when I was like in my 20s or something like that. But I definitely am a better writer now. I think I understand how things work in terms of the structure, like we've been talking about, better. And that all comes from experience. And it's not just from writing comics. In fact, it's mostly not from writing comics, because this is only really the second or third comic that I've been working on. So, yeah, I totally feel you, man.
Well, I mean, you referenced like kind of writing other stuff. I've seen recently you posting about kind of writing lyrics again. How does that differ, or that approach to you now? Like, is that similar thing, kind of having a structure to kind of what you want to hit lyrically and fleshing it out? Or does that work different when you're kind of working... At that point, you're kind of working within a melody and kind of tone and rhythm. Is that a different kind of you know, part of your brain when you're writing lyrics versus even comics or sequential stuff?
Mm-hmm. Man, I like you. You actually do a lot of homework, don't you? That's awesome. So yeah, so I'm writing lyrics. A friend of mine, who's got a thrash metal band.
I saw that. Trevor. I was like, that would be awesome.
Yeah, I mean, he's got a couple bands, and he just signed to a big label. I can't say what it is. He told me, but it's great. He's got a couple bands, Ash and Horde. I have a record label now, and we put out a cassette tape that goes along with the prose story that I wrote, called To Megatherion, which is also anthropomorphic, about a dinosaur barbarian king in his final days. That's out now. So we did a cassette for that, for his band Ash and Horde. He's got another band called Abhorria, and now he's got a new band that he wants to do, a thrash metal band. And since we collaborated and we've become friends through the Metalheads podcast, although ironically I've never actually talked to him on the Metalheads podcast, the other guys interviewed him before I was actually on the cast, but I chat with him all the time. So he asked me to do these lyrics, and I was like, sure, I'll do that. And it is. It's really different. I did lyrics when maybe I was a teenager, and I had some friends who would strum on the acoustic guitars, and I sang and I wrote lyrics a long, long time ago. So doing this, he sent me all the music, and he is like, you know, I kind of want these songs to be about something, you know, about, it could be like political, it could be, you know, cultural. It's like, I want them to touch on something. I was like, I like to do more fun kind of stuff, but let me see what I can do. And he brought out all this stuff in me just through the music that I didn't even know that I had to say. You know, I've written some blogs and posts about things that are going on in the United States. But so, yeah, it's actually really easy to write lyrics for me. It's super easy. Mm-hmm. I've written a ton of them. Trevor is like, he's like, you're a machine. I come up with a concept, and then it just flows out of me. And I used to take poetry when I was in college. I took the classes, and my professor, Louis Turco, who's still with us, he wrote the Book of Forms that's used in a lot of colleges. And it's all the structure interesting. Now I didn't even put this together, but I think I owe a lot to this class. It's all structure, Kyle, about how to write poems, you know, different ways, when it's like rhyme, rhythm. And he was a master at it because he wrote the book on it. And I love that. I thought that was the coolest thing that I didn't realize. I thought poetry was just some beatniks coming up with some kind of freestyle thing. And it's not really the case. You know, a lot of poetry has a form to it, like it says in the Book of Forms. So I think all those lessons in how to do form helped with lyrics. And when I'm doing lyrics, I'm talking about one thing. So it's a lot different than writing a comic book where I have to balance all these different characters and story. And like we've been talking about, sci-fi elements, fantasy elements, action, humor. When I'm writing song lyrics, when I'm writing, it's basically poetry, you know, for music, it just flows out of me, that one thing. And I love it because it's almost like I pick a structure and then it's just super creative. How can I creatively explain this? How can I paint the picture with words? Because it doesn't necessarily have to be like a complete sentence. You know, it can just be words that evoke an emotion, that evoke a scene in your head. I love it. It's been a lot of fun for me to do. And I just wrote one called Blade Runner, which is really fun. It's about it's actually about leaving. It's like leaving the United States, you know, because of all the crazy things that are happening, and just not even the United States, but just leaving a place where I guess things aren't actually working out. The people in charge aren't really doing what they're supposed to do. Maybe it's better to get away. You don't really want to, but maybe it'd just be better to start over where things actually made more sense and things are less false. But I do it in the terms of space travel. So I really liked writing that one.
Yeah, I mean, even like bringing it to comics, it feels like an album would be ostensibly kind of an issue, where, and then so like songs are almost, because they're so, most are so focused on kind of an idea or feeling, it's essentially like you could break it down to a page or a panel and like really focus on that versus, again, kind of telling something over a whole issue. So like, yeah, I would imagine as a writer that would be really fun to explore that. And, you know, like I was in bands and in high school and college, and very much the same. Like I had a very early on in high school, I had like, you know, a Word doc, and I would just write these lyrics in it, and it would just be like, and then we would go to practice and trying to fit lyrics, like that early thing, like not understanding and trying to fit lyrics into like songs versus like writing it together. So it'd be fucking awful. Cringy songs.
It's really interesting, and it helps when the music is great and you get it. And of course, you got to kind of fit that structure of it as well. But it's really fun. And what I've discovered too is just being able to talk to bands. A lot of people approach the lyric writing and songwriting differently. Some people want to have all the lyrics down first before they even write the song. Some bands will write the music first and then put the lyrics in, you know. So we did a soundtrack for By the Horns, which is two-song EP with Arctic Sleep. And Keith D, who's like the mastermind behind that, he really wanted to read the issue and he wanted to talk to me about the emotions of the characters and what they wanted and what they felt and where they were going in their journey before he even crafted it. And then he wanted me to come up with the titles for them. I came up with the titles for each of those songs. And one is, I told him, I was like, you know, this is really cool. I never really thought about doing this because I've only really done music when I was, you know, a teenager. But I kind of want to do one song that's from the perspective of Elodie and the other song that's from the perspective of the unicorns. And so then I came up with the titles and, you know, we talked a lot about the book and the characters and the journey, and then from there he wrote the music and then did the lyrics based on the discussions that we had. So he's like, hey, is there any phrasings or things from the comic book that we can put in here? You know, that would be cool. I'm like, you know, it's your music. You know, you do what you want to do. You know, I can give you a few tidbits in there. But, you know, come up with what feels right based on our discussions. And so that was just a fun, super fun process. I didn't know I was going to be that involved in it, you know, but I'm glad I am. I'm glad that these musicians, and maybe they're the exception to the rule, but they just really want to collaborate, like truly collaborate. And that's part of the joy of working on comics too, you know. I like that idea, the camaraderie, the community, the making of something together. It's really powerful.
There's such kind of an overlap with the two mediums and kind of what they're able to do. I think pulling emotion and kind of then visually versus stereophonic, like the sound and what, like, you know, music's obviously so powerful and kind of the ability to mm-hmm. create emotion through sound. And I think comics with kind of the visual and prose narrative that like they didn't do, I think they both have like these really kind of distinct mediums and abilities to really push that.
Oh yeah, Kyle. Yeah, man. I have sorry to interrupt you. Let me just one other point. But so I have a friend, Nate, who's a guitarist in this great metal band called Immortal Bird. Man, I owe you a phone call, Nate, if you're listening to this. But I met him right before I moved to Hawaii. And we would have the best conversations because comics and music, being in a band, parallel so much. Because you're creating something together. You know, there's all different sensibilities that are happening within the band. You know, there's an element to performance in music that's the same as like writing and drawing and adding color to all of your work. You know, the promotional aspects of it, you know, the merchandising, the connecting with people who really dig your stuff. I feel like I really connect a lot more actually with the musicians than I have with comic book creators. I have a lot of good friends that are in comics as well, but I think that I've connected with musicians more because what they're doing and what I'm doing parallels, but it's still different. Like I'm in the world of comics, they're in the world of metal for the most part. You know, I know a lot of musicians, but mostly I talk to metal musicians. And so we're each really intrigued by that world and how it works in their lives and how our different genres kind of line up. It's been fun to talk about that.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if it was on this. I know I've previously in the past talked about kind of the relationship and comparison and kind of the debate and conversation of like the roles in a band and the roles of like a comic team and kind of like the parallels of that. And then the joke being that the most like confident I feel is a letterer to a bassist because most people don't notice it. The singers or guitarists, which would either be the writers or the artists, feel like they could always just do it themselves. And I feel like everyone thinks they can just play bass when, you know, they can't really. And every so often there's really great bassists that stand out. That's the only one I'm confident in the comparison. But I feel like there's team-wise and band-wise, there's a, you know, there's a lot of overlap kind of like who drives and kind of the layering that happens in that relationship. Yeah, man.
I think you could probably find that in most creative disciplines, you know. There's going to be overlap and how you're creating and interacting with other people if they're part of that process.
So I think before kind of wrap up as to like where people can find you and stuff, if I can ever, like anytime I can talk about music and stuff is always a huge positive. We had Sally, I'm blanking on the name. We were talking about like making an emo comic book one time. So I was like, it just was like me gushing about that for a while. But for someone who kind of is deep in that, does a metal podcast. Like, what were you listening to and consuming when you were creating By the Horns?
That's a good question. I mostly listened to ambient music. So I don't know if you're familiar with that, but like instrumental space, like ambient music. So I really like a guy, he goes by the name of 3-6. Is really great. Another artist named Sangam. So I like to listen to like instrumental stuff when I'm writing. But I also listen to metal too, especially when I'm doing like action scenes and stuff like that. So a lot of what I was listening to for this book is stuff that I was listening to for the Metalheads podcast. And we listen to a lot of metal because we get promos all the time for different bands. And then we're always making our lists and doing our top 25 at the end of the year and mid-year. So one of my favorite records that I listened to while I was writing this is Awake, Devouring Ruin. It's on Translation Loss Records. So I think I got the promo for that like February 2020. So it was like around the time that we had just started working on it, the pitches before we started to get them out to different companies. And that record actually became my number one album for the year, and it came out in February 2020. So it repelled attacks for like 11 months, like a Mandalorian helmet of pure Beskar. And that thing, Devouring Ruin, it's just a behemoth of blackened crust, death metal, and grind metal. And it takes Wake's sound to like a different stratosphere, I think, than what they did before. They have a heavy ferociousness to them. They were more of a grind band before, so like really fast, short, like brutal songs. But then they added all these dynamic textures and layers to their tracks that I think turned them into a phenomenal band. I thought they were already a great band, but they became a phenomenal band. And I like that part of it because of the layers they added to it. When I write comics, there's just always a lot of layering in my comic books. I pride myself on writing comic books that I think that people can easily get into that are fun. But if you look deeper below the surface, you're gonna see a lot more color and layers, like I mentioned before. So I think that's hard to do in comic books, but it's something I like doing. I want people to be able to experience it in different ways, but still have a blast reading it. And so Wake, Devouring Ruin was a great one. I don't know how many you want me to give you. I can give you tons. I'll give you one more.
I'm making a list.
You're making a list. All right. Well, listen, if you go to the metalheadspodcast.com, if you go into the features section, you'll find that we did the top 25 metal albums of 2020. And so there's a podcast for that, but we also posted a list of the albums we all chose. So my list is on there, but all the other guys' list is on there as well. So that would keep you very busy because we each do 25, and sure, there's some overlap, but especially in 2020, we had a lot of different albums. We didn't always see eye to eye on all the albums, but that's part of the magic of the cast, because just so much good stuff out there. But my number two album, it was a little bit different. It's metal still, but it's Emma Ruth Rundle and Thou. It's called May Our Chambers Be Full, and it's on Sacred Bones Records. And this is just a glorious marriage of, I guess, folk sexy sludge and post-metal with a little bit of MTV's Alternative Nation from the 90s. A little bit of 90s in there. And this is a collaboration record. So Emma Ruth Rundle does her own kind of like a folksy rock, and Thou is they're like a sludgy doom metal band. So they combined forces, and it's incredible. I like both of the acts on their own. I've listened to both of them before they put this album out, but together, I think they just made pure magic with this record. I couldn't stop listening to it for a long time. So that's pretty. That's something a little different. What's that, Kyle?
Oh yeah, I mean that sounds. Because I think like growing up in the like hardcore, like post-hardcore, and I was like big into like grindcore, like my especially grindcore, like I. Maybe it's because I like grew up with a mom who like always played like Boyz II Men and Whitney Houston, but I love like metal that is kind of layered and mixed with hooks, like because I think metal is so good in depth at like a depth at like working in hooks. Like I fucking love when you can have more kind of melodic stuff mixed with like heavy breakdowns and stuff like that. Like I think that like the pairing of those two things are so fucking good.
I mean, it can be a disaster too, but you know, yeah. You have to be good. That's true. But yeah, Wake did it amazingly on their album. Like they grew and they did it. I mean, perfectly. It was my number one album. So, and then the same thing with this collaboration. I mean, most collaborations are okay, but this is phenomenal. Like to me, I feel like just give up your other bands and just do this from now on because this is great. Of course, I don't want them to actually do that, but you know what I mean. It's just so good that just become a full-time band and do it. And they actually released an EP this year because they had so much material that came from those sessions that they have another, you know, little half album of stuff. So,
well, Mark's son, you sound like one of the busiest men in the world with the amount of things you have going on. So if anyone wanted to find out more about your comics, your podcast, your music, anything, like where can they hit you up?
Yeah, I mean, you could check out my website at markasan.com. It's MarkIsan. I'm Darth San on Twitter and Darth Markasan on Instagram. If you want to know more about By the Horns or just stay in the know about By the Horns, you can follow us on social media. Our handle is By the Horns Comic on all the platforms, so Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can listen to the Metalheads podcast on your favorite podcast app or just go to metalheadspodcast.com. To play episodes, you could read some features like I was just talking about. I even do a print interview series every now and again with up-and-coming bands called the 10 Horns, where I ask 10 questions of the band, and that's been pretty fun. And you can also go to skullfracturerecords.com. I started a record label that's music based on stories and myth. And started off with a couple of my stories, and hopefully, you know, as we go along with the record company, that we'll be able to get other things in there as well. But, you know, we put out an original soundtrack for By the Horns. It's a 2-song EP by Arctic Sleep. And it officially comes out next Friday, March 5th. I believe it's the 5th. But there's one song that you can stream on Bandcamp. If you just go to skullfracturerecords.com, we'll have links to it. The vinyl's available in purple vinyl, blue vinyl, and orange vinyl on Scout's website, Scout Orange. So it comes with a download code, so even if you don't have a record player, you can have a cool collectible and still like be able to play the music. Yeah, man, that's the stuff. I do have a lot of stuff going on, but you know what? It's great. I really enjoy doing all this. I love that the comic book's finally out and people are really enjoying it. And I had a blast on this podcast. Thanks for asking all these questions about writing.
Oh, no problem, man. Like I can't express enough how much I enjoy this issue. And like I said, I think for first issues, it's difficult. And you guys hit it out of the park with this one. So if you're listening, it is out. Again, you can pick it up on Scout, on your local store. However you can do it. We well worth your time. Tim will be mad if I don't. I always forget to mention anything about the podcast. We're on Twitter at pages_panels. I should know. And then all the podcast stuff. I just recently started a new podcast with my cousin, best friend, known all my life. It's called Is It Too Bad? I think you can look it up that way on any of the stuff. But me and him are going chronologically through every Nickelback song to find out if they are the worst band of all time. So I think we're in...
They're definitely not the worst band of all time.
No. They're not good, at least so far. We're, I think, the second... I didn't know they had an EP.
I mean, I'm no fan, but I mean, it's not the worst band.
No. Yeah, we're in the second album, The State. I still have yet to be familiar with any of the songs, but you can check that out. But again, most importantly is checking out everything Marcuson has going on. It sounds like at some point during the day he may find time for sleep. I don't know, but
I only sleep 5 hours. He's got a lot of great things. So.
That's all you need. I try and tell my wife that. But she complains because I probably get around that at night, but she apparently wants me to help out with the kids and all that other stuff, which I have to get up to do. Thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it so much.
Yeah, thank you, Kyle.
No problem. And next episode we will return to our George Lopez coverage. I apologize to anyone tuning in for that. But thank you so much.